Okay, this is session 19, October 9th, 2006, side one, and we're continuing the McLuhan column, which is the quotes on the right-hand side of my book, from page 5 to 47, and we're doing page 37 of the McLuhan thread, and we're now moving into the last session we talked about McLuhan's early notion of a primitive kind of media ecology that he wrote in an article about 1949. Now, 20 years later, in Playboy magazine, he's being interviewed and he lays out a more sophisticated form of media ecology. So Scott's going to read a statement McLuhan says sort of in the middle of the Playboy interview. It's actually, if you had the original, I don't have the page, page number is. If you had the original Playboy magazine, it's pages 72 and 74 that we're quoting from. But you can read this interview in the book called The Essential McLuhan, published in the middle 90s. So this is a Playboy interview, March 1969. Just for the record, in April 69, Playboy had an interview with Ginsberg. So you matched up the two major poets of North America in that period. First McLuhan, and then the April issue did Ginsberg. And the two of them met, and Ginsberg, the hidden story is that he hugged McLuhan, and McLuhan wasn't very comfortable with that, for who knows what reasons. Or maybe Ginsberg misinterpreted McLuhan's body language, who knows?
Well, you don't think McLuhan was a little stiff? After all, Ginsberg's gay and soft and squishy, and McLuhan's a bit, detached.
Well, if you have a certain limited experience with McLuhan, but you're not necessarily like that once you knew him better, he might have been stiff as a stage mannerism. He did it on purpose because he had a picture. If you saw photos of him in the middle, late 60s, when he was becoming pretty famous, and they had a picture of him in the office, he had a big photo of Allen Ginsberg in his office sort of hanging over his shoulder.
Oh.
So what was that all about? That could have been, and he allowed himself to be photographed with it. It was like he's showing the figure, Ginsberg, and he's the ground. So McLuhan was pretty conscious that way. Why would he have a picture of a drug-taking homosexual poet in his office and allow it to be photographed? So there's something to think about.
Yeah.
McLuhan was very careful in his media management of his image.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's begin with you reading. We're in the middle of the Playboy interview, and McLuhan says...
Yeah, and this first sentence, probably I should read it and then get oriented, because he says, "All these convulsive changes, as I've already noted, carry with them attendant pain, violence, and war." So what are the convulsive changes he's referring to?
He's talking about moving from a visually biased society, a print society, a mechanical society, into an electronic, organic society, mass man society, all the changes that he wrote about in his books.
Mm-hmm.
So these convulsive changes of the major Gutenberg era, now shifting into the Marconi era, and then the satellite era, that's a big span of time. So a lot of history happens in those 500 years, say.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what he's referring to, and he's been laying it all out in the previous paragraphs in the interview.
Right. "All these convulsive changes, as I've already noted, carry with them attendant pain, violence, and war, the normal stigmata of the identity quest. But the new society is springing so quickly from the ashes of the old that I believe it will be possible to avoid the transitional anarchy many predict. Automation and cybernation can play an essential role in smoothing the transition to the new society." And the Playboy guy asks, how
could you do that? Yeah, how could automation and cybernation do this?
Marshall replies, "The computer can be used to direct a network of global thermostats to pattern life in ways that will optimize human awareness. Already it's technologically feasible to employ the computer to program societies in beneficial ways." Playboy, "How do you program an entire society, beneficially or otherwise?" and Marshall. There's nothing at all difficult about putting computers in the position where they will be able to conduct carefully orchestrated programming of the sensory life of whole populations. I know it sounds rather science fictional, but if you understood cybernetics, you'd realize that we could do it today. A computer could program the media to determine the given messages of people should hear in terms of their overall needs, creating a total media experience absorbed and patterned by all the senses. We could program our 5 hours less of TV in Italy to promote the reading of newspapers during an election, or lay on an additional 25 hours of TV in Venezuela to cool down the tribal temperature raised by radio the preceding month. By such orchestrated interplay of all media, whole cultures could now be programmed in order to improve and stabilize their emotional climate, just as we are beginning to learn how to maintain equilibrium among the world's competing economies. Playboy. How does such environmental programming, however enlightened in intent, differ from Pavlovian brainwashing? Marshall. Your question reflects the usual panic of people confronted with unexplored technologies. I'm not saying such panic isn't justified, or that such environmental programming couldn't be brainwashing, or far worse, merely that such reactions are useless and distracting. Though I think the programming of societies could actually be conducted quite constructively and humanistically, I don't want to be in the position of a Hiroshima physicist extolling the potential of nuclear energy in the first days of August 1945. But an understanding of the media's effects constitute a civil defense against media fallout. The alarm of so many people, however, at the prospect of corporate programming's creation of complete service environment on this planet is rather like fearing that a municipal lighting system will deprive the individual of the right to adjust each light to his own favorite level of intensity. Computer technology can, and doubtless will, program entire environments to fulfill the social needs and sensory preferences of communities and nations. The content of that programming, however, depends...
And the content, the word content is in italics.
Yeah. The content of that programming, however, depends on the nature of future societies, but that is in our own hands.
So that's quite a mouthful. It's a famous mouthful. Those that read enough people want to encounter this dialogue as part of the Playboy interview.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think of that?
What everybody complains about, that morals or ethics don't keep pace with technology, and that's why we're in trouble.
Yeah.
It would take really conscious humanity to follow this prescription. I mean, Marshall must have realized that what he was saying was interesting to consider, but not feasible.
Yes, and then one would say he's being a satirist, but what he's doing, he's providing a solution. If you complained or critiqued the society, generally people had to come up with a solution. So he's giving a solution, and he has a great rationalization. He says, just as we're beginning to learn how to maintain equilibrium among the world's competing economies, we accept that kind of programming through interest rates and that. Why wouldn't we accept these other environments? So traditionally, the ideal notion of the artist is that the artist orchestrates the materials that he makes his art out of. And so McLuhan is taking that traditional role of the artist and expanding it and updating it and not worrying about artists working with particular puny older media. He's being an artist in orchestrating the whole global environment because he's in the satellite perspective going around the planet. So to the degree this is an art statement or a mind-stimulating statement, he is parodying the role of the artist, or he's seriously updating it, showing that if you really want to be an artist today, you got to deal with these new media as art forms, not the content of the media as art forms. So that was his challenge to the conventional idealizing of the artist in in society in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, he has a chapter in the book From Cliché to Archetype called The Artist, The Identity Hero. Well, funny, I forgot. Culture as Identity Hero, something like that. It's about the artist being and satisfying people's striving for a collective identity, and the artist becomes a figure for that,
mm-hmm.
becomes the culture hero, more than the politicians or whatever. And Andy Warhol said that in the 60s, the artist was the culture hero. He didn't use that phrase, but just said everybody looked up to artists. And then he said in the 70s, everybody looked up to athletes. So that's a shift. Now, McLuhan would explain the ground of that shift. Warhol would just be honest enough to point out the shift and not claim that art is the be-all and end-all in the 70s. So the point is that both of them, artists in the 60s and athlete in the 70s, are culture heroes. And people get identity from that.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said at the top here, what was that phrase about identity crisis? Was it? The normal, in the very beginning of the quote back in page 37, the beginning of what you read, he says, the normal stigmata of the identity quest, pain, violence, and war. So he's saying we smooth the identity quest since artists and athletes are just content figures and not really going to provide a role for the establishing a stable identity or comprehensive identity, because we're inside these processes that are so big that we have to use a computer to program these environments, and that would stabilize the identity quest.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, would you say that we're in these really huge environments now that we've talked about everything being the chip keeps making everything smaller and smaller and more holeopathic.
Right. No. Yeah. What he's presenting back then is media ecology, and I don't think that's applicable today. So I call it paramedia ecology.
Mm-hmm.
And paramedia ecology points out that the Android meme is in a very subtle controlling position, and the only way out of the pain, violence, and war that is happening now is a flip into new hardware, cold fusion. So that's the antidote. Managing the media is impossible anymore.
Yeah.
But we can talk about what we could do while we're waiting. No, what answers were provided by the people in this book over the last 40 years, use that to think about, since this world is based on thought now,
yeah.
lives at the speed of thought, and maybe that has effects as we move toward the environmental breakthrough of cold fusion.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that me offering cold fusion as the be-all and end-all of this dilemma we're in, where you can't even do McLuhan's media ecology anymore, that is an art statement in itself. Or that's me being like McLuhan,
mm-hmm.
and pretending to know exactly what is going to break us out of this problem.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there is no separate media. Back then there was radio and TV, separate media environments. There isn't that separation anymore. That's why when you read Understanding Media, the separate media now don't exist for people.
What made them separate back then and not separate today? Because they're all inside the chip now?
Yeah, they're all inside your Palm Pilot. You can listen to radio.
Mm-hmm.
You have an ear experience. You can look at a video experience. You can read newspapers. You can read books. All these things, all these different earlier media that came in stages, chronologically later phases, they're all there simultaneously for whoever's using it.
Mm-hmm.
So what is that seamless web? I call it the Android meme. And remember, did I talk about that?
Why do you call it a seamless web?
And McLuhan said that the electronic environment has created a seamless web. But now it's even, he was sort of saying the electronic environment is a seamless web. But all the media through history are now part of the seamless web.
What do you mean by seamless? I mean a web.
There's no division.
Visualize a seamless web. A web is a web.
Right, but seamless means there's no divisions. Like, you know, you look at the seams of a stocking.
Yeah.
And then seamless stockings came in.
Right.
But seamless means there's no line that seems to be a border. There's no borders between.
Well, there maybe not at the chip level, but at the level of experiential level, when I turn on the radio, I'm not watching the TV. There is a difference.
Well, yeah. The thing is that on my chart, I show that is an after image of when there was only the ear environment via radio. See, and when there was just radio, and no, you couldn't turn on TV, you had to deal with the landscape and effects that radio created in the teens, 20s, and 30s, all right, which led to World War II. You now can be, it's actually a tactile experience because you can go to radio, to TV, to eye, and rapidity, so you're almost miming the way the central platform of your brain, which is the tactile mechanism that integrates individual sensory data, you're getting very close to living a tactile reality. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when there was radio, and before that when there was newspapers and telegraphs, but no radio, those were separate, distinct landscapes that went on for a few decades.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's no beginning and no end.
Well, yeah, every time the new technology came in, the old one became the content.
Yeah.
So in that way it became subsumed by the new technology,
right.
I guess.
Right. So then what is the content when you have a seamless web? The user is the content. And did I mention the BlackBerry Pearl ad?
I think the user is the content because he's inside the environment, so he becomes content for the environment?
Yes. The previous environments were the content. But what he wrote in the middle 60s. In the late 60s, early 70s, he starts... In the book Take Today, came out in 72, but he was writing that 68 to 71. He talks about the user as the content, and he's beginning to deal with the implosion of the seamless web, and the interplay of all the media is shrinking. And that led to, as I was saying, did I bring up the BlackBerry cell phone ad last week?
No.
Okay, I found this ad a week or so ago. New BlackBerry cell phones called the BlackBerry Pearl. It says, on the big poster, it says, small, smart, and stylish. So you can live large. So you, the user, can live large as the media seamless web on your cell phone is small, smart, and stylish. That's your artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So you see... Even the advertisers for these new products understand the effect that it's going to make you feel larger than media. So the user, it's very interesting when you read McLuhan on the user as content and how he plays with it. That's a really important idea that is pointing to the shrinking of media and the fact that the user becomes, in a way, his own matrix pod.
Mm-hmm.
The user becomes more and more of the content. And that's why at the end, he says, of that quote, he says, where is this? The content, and he italicizes it. Now, you must have instructed Playboy to italicize it. The content, and this is before people knew he had the phrase, the user is the content, because he's writing this in 68. He hasn't been talking about the user's content that early publicly. The content of that programming, however, depends on the nature of future societies, but that is in our own hands. See, that's in our hands, the content, the user. The multi-level statement there.
Mm-hmm.
The content, you could just say the content of the programming. Why is it italicized? Because he means there's other meanings to content. So he's implying the effects of his later statement, the user is the content, is in that sentence. Because he says that is in our hands. The content is the part we think we can modulate. And that's the more and more as media... becomes digital, you can modulate what you experience.
Mm-hmm.
So the user's preference...
Yeah, but I'm modulating the content. That doesn't make me the content.
Yes, when you listen to radio or watch TV in the mass period, mass one-way broadcasting, others determined the content. And your relationship to it was...
I bet it was still dependent on the pollsters.
No.
Feedback, you know, what does the audience want? Give them what they want, because then we can hit them with the advertising.
Okay, that was based on national cultural stereotypes. There are no stereotypes now. As they said in the 80s and 90s, fashion broke down because the girls and women were designing their own kind of clothing. There was no comprehensive trend, overall hegemonic trend. You had stereotypes you could play with, but as the mediascape fragmented in the 70s, 80s, 90s, you had demographics and niche marketing. So the more and more the archetypes became diverse. And so it was getting closer and closer until now you can program your whole environment around your particular preferences.
Mm-hmm.
The color of the cell phone you get, what kind of ringtone you have. It's just the endless.
Right.
What you can stylistically design around yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes more, gives you more of a sense of you control. Right. And because the, as McLuhan said in Take Today, the figure and the ground merge, and man becomes both figure and ground, that situation you get, the user is the content. The content is the user, and the media is disappearing, so all there is the user and his editing. Look at that movie, The Devil Wears Prada, about a magazine editor. There's a new culture hero. In the 90s, I could see that in New York City. More and more of the celebrities were the editors. And I would say that was the older media picking up their bureaucratic administrative role of the editor and mirroring. That was the closest the older media could do to match with the new effect, which was everybody was becoming their own editor of their matrix pod. Because there was so much fragmented media, you could, as McLuhan said, you are a pattern information. It's your particular pattern that you that you could create with your media mix, which was handier to do that. And so then on the internet, the surveillances started tracking where you went to what websites to determine a consumer profile and then try to target you. You know,
mm-hmm.
you heard about that, right?
Oh, yeah.
So that's because they didn't have stereotypes to work with anymore. So they had to spy on you to find out what particular minuscule quark-like patterns of media you used.
Mm-hmm.
So the user is the content is a very important development of McLuhan's work.
Mm-hmm.
And he would say in Canada they had the Canadian Radio and Television Communications Control bureaucracy, CRTC, and they would demand media, Canadian media, to play or show 10 or 15%, whatever it was, Canadian content, Canadian-made stuff. And McLuhan used to make fun of this bureaucratic intent because he said, if a Pakistani comes to Canada and watches a Canadian movie, it's a Pakistani movie. Because a Pakistani puts his cultural knowledge and experience into the content of the show. So everybody projects their own content in an environment. Mm-hmm. And so with that, that's what the older media, the Pakistani, projects its content and sees a Pakistani-Canadian movie. The Pakistani the meaning of Pakistani conditioning is adjusted to whatever the movie is doing,
mm-hmm.
and it's projected into it. Now, when you get the increasing individualization so that you can live large, then the idea of someone being a Pakistani or a French person or Canadian doesn't apply, because as the decentralization takes place all over various countries, the fragmentation, you have cultural regional preferences surfacing. And then you have each individual person who's consuming all kinds of radio and all kinds of TV, and they certainly don't have the same favorites as the person next to them. So it becomes really minuscule. So the person becomes the cultural stereotype. But you got to find out what their, I shouldn't say the person is a cultural stereotype. The individual becomes the stereotype that has to be tracked. But you have to track the individual to find out what their stereotypical behavior is for them. So in that sense, the user is the content, no longer national stereotypes or any.
You know, well, we'll probably see an extreme extension of that as we move into this new RFID technology, where you go into a clothing store, you buy some clothes, and there's an RFID chip embedded in you know, your socks, your pants, and your shirt that you just bought, and you go in buy a new wallet, and then you're walking down the street, and there's, or you walk through you know, the front door of a shopping mall, and there's a scanner there, and he's scanning your clothes and your wallet, and if you're a woman, whatever you have inside your bag, even maybe any articles of food that have packaging or whatever, all that's being scanned and input into a computer, so they know exactly what your personal buying habits are.
Right. So the, as McClellan said, to think that programming our environments is a fascistic environment, a fascistic problem. What does he say that? He says, I'm not saying, he says, the panic. The guy says that's environmental programming is Pavlovian brainwashing. And he says, I'm not saying such panic isn't justified. But he says, your question reflects the usual panic of people confronted with unexplored technologies. So in the scanning of the chip in the purse, in the woman's purse, the acceptance of that is almost the public recognition that everything is so individualized and anarchic, because there's no standard stereotypes, that they allow the programming, the surveillance of everybody, so some patterns of consumer profiles can be made to market towards. We're accepting the Orwellian, what's called the Orwellian, more and more, because it's not, it's actually a good counterbalance to the individualization where 6 billion people are feeling large. So what were we going to say?
Well, I just thought of another example, which is in a lot of web guys. When you go to their website, everybody knows about cookies now. When you go to their website, you click on links, and it tracks you through cookies to figure out what links you clicked on, to find out what what moved you in to go into this page or that page, what was of interest to you there. And then they have a whole bag full of different kinds of ads, and then they try to match up the ad with your clicking patterns, you know, to try to match up the ad with you.
You see, like, it's at the speed of ESP.
Yeah. But another, now this was kind of...
Here's a phrase McClellan would use, was the communities need to know. So you have, you know, in all through society, there has to be a group consensus for the society to be coherent, just like I think we had an earlier quote where he said community is analogy. There has to be some metaphor, some idea. You could say some cultural sharing of what God is, God being the metaphor for the ultimate coherence. The communities need to know changes with different media. So people more and more accept the Orwellian ESP of surveillance, because they feel that that's the only way we can find out what's going on. And that's an extension of the community's need to know.
Yeah.
And they have to do this massive surveillance of everybody to get patterns.
Yeah.
So it's like Big Brother's playing catch-up.
Right.
And we're saying, it's really hard to control anything now, so why don't we let Big Brother do as much as it can to attempt to track us? So, McClellan.
It was interesting on our Bell show the other night. He had this guy on who's a expert in all this surveillance technology, and you know, he's very paranoid about all of it, and he paints all the Big Brother scenarios, and he imagines that the people, everyone listening to him, are going to be upset about losing their privacy and the potential of being tracked on minute levels. And he started asking Art Bell, he says, I mean, like, what are your limitations? I mean, would you care if they were tracking your phone calls and listening to them? And Art goes, no, not really. My phone calls are pretty boring. He goes, well, what if they were tracking your banking and your money transactions? And Art goes, nah, I don't know. I wouldn't really care if they tracked that either. It's all pretty mundane. And then the guy says, well, what if they tracked, you know, he went down the list, and Art was like, not really. It's okay with me.
Whether
the only place where he stopped, he goes, well, what if they tracked your medical records? And he goes, well, I don't know why they would need to do that. I might draw the line there.
Right, but the thing is, either he was doing a put-on, or that was his genuine art self, and he was representing what a big majority of people think. They don't think that they don't think they have privacy. In the old way, privacy was you had a certain opinion about religion and politics, and it meant something. Back then, it was important whether you were Catholic or Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
In the 19th century. And so your opinions and your what you really were thinking was a problem for society. So you kept to yourself, and you had public rituals where you would express yourself, like elections. Now, and those were based on literary media. You had an opinion, you know, based on manuscript culture. Now, that's 100 years ago, and we got many media. Many people aren't into manuscript culture, aren't religious. They might put on other cultures' religion, but they don't have points of view. They have strategies, mental cliches to respond to all the different people they meet in their life. And sometimes they aren't very fluid about it, and they have clashes. But we don't have a point. We don't have a privacy to protect like they did 100 years ago. And your example is really good. Art, none of that. His chemical body privacy needs is a big problem with him. You know, so another thing about him, he doesn't really have a point of view on his show because he deals with so many different guests, and he has to modulate with them. He's an example. You could look at Art Bell as an example of the way you are, or anybody is, in an urban environment, dealing with all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. Or in other words, for your life, all these different guests. And you're not going to argue with every one of them. He has to sort of go along with whatever their theme is and pretend.
Well, he's going along with it because he doesn't have a problem with Homeland Security and believes that all this stuff should be monitored, because if it could potentially save millions of lives if they catch somebody trying to sneak a nuke into the country, then it would be worth it, and who cares if they know what, you know, personal stuff about him.
Yeah, and that expresses a very conventional idea, and it's probably the idea that will help the Republicans do well and not as bad as the Democrats are hoping in next month.
Yeah.
That's a general tribal. If McLuhan had and take today the sentence, tribal societies are always in a level of war preparedness. They do war preparedness 24/7. It's kind of live in a paranoid state. Well, the old tribal identities, chemical body tribal groups, are very paranoid today because they are very fragile, and there's no solidity to their media, their old media reference points. So Art sounds like a very conventional American.
Mm-hmm.
And he's conventional in the way he encounters all these different strange opinions and kind of expresses interest in them, but then goes on, has another guest the next night.
Yeah.
And I call that metaphysical promiscuity.
Mm-hmm.
Informational promiscuity.
Yeah.
So what to be afraid of is not being addressed in the society. What we're afraid of, as McLuhan was pointing out, and maybe even satirizing, that the panics, the usual panics people have, is not, and he's not saying that we shouldn't panic, but we're panicking backwards. He says, I'm not saying such panic isn't justified, or that such environmental programming couldn't be brainwashing, or far worse, merely that such reactions are useless and distracting, because the people don't even begin to understand the implications of speech being obsolete.
Yeah.
And they just argue over what people speechify about.
Yeah.
Even philosophers, in the mid-50s or mid-20th century, there was a philosopher who wrote a book called Speech Acts. Even philosophers could start to notice speech acts.
Yeah.
But McLuhan was dealing with media acts.
Yeah.
ACT.
Yeah. Well, it's becoming a little clearer to me about how this identity is established through visual space. Because you think about it, Art's a radio guy. So he's not as attached to the privacy of the visual space guy.
That's right.
You know, but the visual space guy is like, well, you're imposing on my identity, my privacy, my identity. People grasp their identities pretty firmly. They're afraid to lose their identities.
Which is usually a media mix.
Yeah.
Their clothing. Not clothing per se, but the media they use. Like,
my identity is what makes me special, you know. Now, Art's coming from the point of view, he goes, if anybody looked at my financial affairs or my private affairs, or they were eavesdropping on my conversations, they'd find out that they're just like everybody else's. There's nothing really all that special about it.
Is that what he said?
Yeah.
Nothing special about how he lives his life, because the chemical body is forced to be uniform for most people, because their TV and chip body is where their diversity is.
Oh.
The information they consume. But everybody has to drive, the chemical body has to drive a car, use a telephone, and so the chemical body is put through routines because it's marginalized. And everybody's the same on the chemical body level.
Yeah.
But not on the TV and chip body. They needed the chip to surveil the increasingly diversified TV body landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's interesting. I just noticed the next quote. I go into the user as the content. So I must have placed that. I saw the content italicized of that programming, however, depends on the nature of future societies, but that is in our own hands. And then I jumped ahead and brought in a quote where he talks about the content, users of content. So let's go to that next quote.
Okay.
I think the media programming is something we've talked about for many sessions, and it's obvious what he's saying. Whether it's a practical or not, another question. But the thing I've added to that is that in the seamless web that we have under Android Meme conditions, McLuhan's media ecology with separate environments today wouldn't be applicable. So I just want to say that. So we're dealing with the, and I'm probably the only person who says that, and that's why I come up with the term paramedia rather than media ecology. A paramedia meaning para, it's beside, above, below, inside, all around you, it's parallel to you. That's the way we are. And so that leads to the situation where the user is the content. So I place the Playboy interview quote ending with the word content in italics, and then I come up with this statement published 3 years later in Take Today, page 45. And let's read this quote where I point out where McLuhan is sort of starting to reveal his new notion of the user as the content.
Okay.
And remember, he had said in the 60s that previous environments were the content of new invisible environments. And those old content environments became figure and therefore art forms. But now he's saying the user is the content.
Keeping in mind that the user is necessarily the content of any man-made service environment or media, it's noteworthy that with Sputnik, men put the planet inside its first man-made container. From that time, people had an immediate sense of being the, quote, content kings of the Earth.
Yeah, feeling, living large.
Mm-hmm.
Content king of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Like feeling you're living large, right? Remember the ads? So you can live large.
Yeah. As the content of the planet, they suddenly noticed how poor a job nature had done in keeping men in line. If, quote, what the public wants,
unquote,
was the child of the telegraph press.
Was the first child of the telegraph press.
In capital letters, ecology, was the first progeny of Sputnik. When processes moved up to electric speeds, it became obvious that, quote, everything causes everything.
Causes in italics.
Mm-hmm. For every cause, there are many effects, just as every effect has many causes. This becomes apparent to those existing in an electric environment of information.
At that point, they don't adopt one particular cause and effect point of view. So it's natural to not have a point of view when you're a citizen in electric environments because you're aware of too many factors. So McLuhan said that's the discovery of the technique of the suspended judgment, suspended point of view. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So those existing, read that.
Those existing as content of a man-made environment never cease adjusting it to their own behavior. Just as they adjust their behavior to the environment. Quote, programming, unquote. The environment had this form of slow adjustment earlier. However, for the residents of the, quote, wired planet or the magnetic city, the programming now begins to assume the character of rapid and extensive change, which we take for granted on radio, movies, and TV. Sputnik and the moonshots brought about, in effect, the institution of a new kind of global theater in which all men become actors and there are few spectators. The population of the world is both the cast and content of this new theater. The repertory of the theater consists of a perpetual happening, and that's italicized, which can include the retrieval or italicized replay of any previous happenings that men choose to experience. The replay of past events in, quote, realistic...
No, the replaying.
The replaying of past events in, quote, realistic ways began with the power of print to retrieve the ancient authors and historians. The Elizabethan stage projected scenes and characters of the past as a staple entertainment. Our power to reconstruct the past has grown steadily with media enlargement, till Hollywood made such replays into a major feature of this century.
So do you have a sense of how the user becomes the content as you get into the global theater of mixed media and replaying events and all that stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Can you see why?
Well, especially if I look at the user as consisting of a pattern of information.
Yeah, and the information is media environments, both the form and the content, which are increasingly merging. So when he says those existing as the content of a man-made environment never cease adjusting it to their own behavior, they start to have a bit of control over and fitting into their behavior, just as they adjust their behavior to the environment. Before the 70s and 80s, people had to adjust their behavior to the environment, and programming the environment had this form of slow adjustment earlier. It was slow adjustment. Now people can adjust the environment to their own behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see the general trend that led to the war on terror was people becoming indifferent to the global American environment and going inward into their own local media mix and then getting quite militant about it and saying, you have no right to bring your technologies and Hollywood movies into this area.
Yeah. I'm thinking of a TV commercial where...
That's an attempt to adjust the media to them.
Yeah.
Okay, what were we going to say?
I'm thinking of a TV commercial that's kind of popular. They're running it a lot right now. All these people are in the office, and they're all in a meeting. And everybody's adjusting their behavior to the requirements of the office and the requirements of the protocols of the meeting and all this kind of stuff.
Do they say that?
No, it's just that this is what's implied.
Yeah.
Then... somebody comes up with the bright idea that they ought to just all take off and go to Las Vegas and play games, and the boss walks in, and everybody gets kind of like there's a moment where everybody's nervous because they said this in front of the boss, and then the boss looks over. There's a crowd of people outside the building that are all part of the Verizon network of telephone and computer and television networks and all this stuff. So he looked.
Employees?
No. They're just all crowded around outside. They're using this as an analogy that this invisible network around us, which provides us with telephones, computers, and cell phones and everything, is being supported by thousands and thousands of people all the time. We just don't see those people hard at work to support this, invisible environment. So he looks out the window and he sees all the people that are supporting this invisible environment.
They're employed by Verizon.
They're employee. They're all Verizon employees.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so he looks out there and he realizes, yeah, let's get out of this stupid office and let's all go to Las Vegas, because on the way to Las Vegas we can have our meeting over the cell phone. We can communicate via email through wireless internet. We can do video conferencing. Let's just go play, and then we'll adjust the work environment to our behavior.
Yeah.
So that was the point of the commercial.
Right. So that is becoming a cliche. I mean, as we move into the post-chip body, and the chip environment made the user as the content, starting in the 70s, allowed the person to adjust the environment to them according to their own preferences. As we've had that for 30 years, it's now kind of well known because we've moved into a new environment. So these patterns of awareness surface as figures and ads, like I just said about the BlackBerry and what you're just citing. So the new environment is a strange caveman wilderness, and therefore everything focuses on the Middle East, because that's like in Afghanistan. That's like a primitive caveman area. We focus on that as to reflect where we really think we are. We're not there. In actual fact, we're in a post-chip body landscape. But that's post-McCollin. So let's go back to some of the things here. It's the Sputnik and the moonshots brought about, in effect, the institution of a new kind of global theater in which all men become actors and there are few spectators. The population of the world is both the cast and content of this new theater. The act, what he used to say is there are no spectators in the global theater, there's no passengers in the global theater, just crew. Everybody's crew. And yet people adopt a position. They're either the people on the stage temporarily and the people in the audience, but they switch positions. They're both cast and content. So this is what's going on in the hidden ground of the 60s. So the simple one-way medium is a massage point that McLuhan's saying is pre-60s. He's just explaining how history was numb to that process till we got to the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Because programming the environment was slower.
Mm-hmm.
The adjustment required could be slower because there wasn't that many changes. What's he say here? He says, the programming now begins to assume the character of rapid and extensive change, which we take for granted on radio, movies, and TV. There's already a lot of change going on in the content. But now we expect rapid change happening to us and to the programming mandates. You see how he writes that?
Mm-hmm.
The programming now begins to assume the character of rapid and extensive change. In other words, programming itself is almost any rapid change. Remember that quote from Counterblast, page 31? Rapid series of aerosats and environments appears to be an anti-environment or a controlling. So we have moved into this paralysis. So you have rapid programming, which appears to be adjustment.